I just want to take a moment to tell you about an event coming up in March 2023. So very soon and very exciting. The Emerging Voices for Animals and Tourism Conference online is coming up from March 8th to the 10th. Now, this may seem like a super niche conference for academics, but au contraire. Having attended this conference for the first time last year, I can tell you that there is so much going on in the world of animals and tourism, and this conference isn't just meant for academics. If you've ever thought about visiting countries and seeing the wildlife, participated in wildlife photography shots at zoos, or wanted to join in helping conservation in an ecotourism vacation, then you are going to want to attend this conference. And this year, The Deal with Animals and I, Marika Bell, will be covering the conference by interviewing many of the speakers in the days before and after the conference. This mini-series and conference will help to highlight some of the emerging voices in academia, bringing to light both the issues and the intrigue of animals in tourism. For updates on when registration becomes available, search Emerging Voices for Animals and Tourism on Facebook or thecivitproject.com. You can also find a link on my Facebook page. Just search for The Deal with Animals, and I hope to see you there.
I don't know of any human being, really, who is likely to go through a life without grief. I think it would be a sad life because I think there'd be less love in that life. And to know that we're not alone and that we feel other beings around us who also have these deep emotional states, at least to me, is a real solace.
Welcome to The Deal with Animals. I'm Marika Bell, anthrozoologist, CPDT certified dog trainer, and an animal myself. This is a podcast about the connection and interaction between humans and other animals.
I love this question. What's the deal with animals?
What do I think is the deal with animals? I think the deal with animals, for one, I think is they're awesome.
What do you think is the deal with animals?
Okay, starting with the shout out this week, a big shout out to Algeria. I don't have a lot of African countries in my audience yet, nor has any of my analytics told me where in Algeria people are listening from. However, I would like to say hi to you. I would love to know what episode you got excited about. Send me a message on thedealwithanimals.com or Facebook at /MSAnthrozoo, or, you know, just search Deal with Animals, or on Twitter at The Deal with Animals Podcast. Okay, here we go. Episode 55. Do other animals grieve? And if so, what does it mean for how we relate to them? And if non-human animals can experience grief, what other emotions do they experience? In her poignant book, How Animals Grieve, Barbara King discusses her work studying grief and other emotions in non-human animals. We discuss how different species grieve, but also individuals grieve, and how important is grief to our human experience. Barbara is an emerita professor of anthropology at William & Mary, a freelance science writer and public speaker. She's the author of 7 books, and her book, How Animals Grieve, has been translated into 7 languages and includes a TED Talk on love and grief, which has received over 3.5 million views. Her work has appeared in Scientific America, Eon, and Undark, and she regularly reviews books for NPR and the TLS. And let me just say, I was so excited she agreed to come on the podcast. I'm really so pleased to share this one with you. So I hope you enjoy this episode as we continue to explore looking at life from other animals' perspectives in Series 6, The Animal Protagonist. Would you please introduce yourself and share your pronouns?
Sure. Yes, I'm Barbara J. King. I'm a biological anthropologist here in Virginia in the United States. I taught for 28 years at William & Mary, and retired early to write and speak about science. My pronouns are she and her.
And your, I guess, most recent research is on emotions in animals. So what is your main focus there?
I have been working for about 12 years now on the expression of both love and grief in other than human animals. I became very interested in this because I'd been working on some research into burial practices of human ancestors and how human ancestors deal with grief and death. And the jumping off point was that to investigate what do we know about grief and mourning and responses to death in other animals. And at the time that I was doing this, this field wasn't the big, explosive, exciting one that it is now. So I was kind of getting in on the ground floor a little bit.
Yeah, sort of before everybody got excited about animal emotions again.
Again.
It's sort of one of those things that goes up and down, isn't it?
You're so right. I mean, really, Charles Darwin was all over this with talking about everything from love, sorrow, fear, grief, jealousy, and then that was lost for a time when animals were considered to be much more simplistic. And we know in the 1960s, Jane Goodall, in part, revived a lot of this and was one of the first to start talking about the expression of grief in chimpanzees.
Hmm. Yeah, her story on the young chimpanzee who lost his mom is one that I think sticks with a lot of people. It's maybe even the first story people hear about when they are taught about emotions in animals, and particularly grief.
I think you're right. She was, of course, and still is, a pioneer in so many ways. And she documented what happened when this wonderful mother, Flo, the chimpanzee, died, and Flint, her offspring, really couldn't recover emotionally. He was physically quite able to take care of himself at the age that he was at her death, but he was depressed, he didn't eat, and she was very willing to come out and say, this is in large part an emotional reaction that he's having. And people really weren't talking about that very much in the 1960s.
Yeah. Yeah, it is, it's funny how she really brought that to research, because a lot of the people I've been talking to recently, and I would love to do a whole series on this, is research in general has changed significantly since more women have become involved in it. And in the past, it has been very much a male perspective in a lot of research. And when Jane Goodall went in, she was sort of an outlier in terms of being a female researcher, it seems like, in that field. In the field, and I don't believe she even, you know, she wasn't really trained as a she didn't seem to have any concern with talking about emotions the way that a lot of researchers are trained to, you know, not talk about emotions in animals in the past.
You might say it hadn't been trained out of her because she hadn't gone to graduate school for this topic. And I do think that is, you know, a story that we all know, that Jane Goodall, Diane Fossey, Birute Galdikas, the three primates who went to study apes in the field, that's respectively chimpanzees, gorillas, and orangutans, changed the field. And there's some truth to that. But I also think we need to remember that in the 1950s, there were a number of Japanese primatologists, and largely men, who were doing incredible work on Japanese macaques in Japan, talking about society, talking about how these animals were not just grouped in ways to feed better or evade predators better, but they made up a kind of important, you know, thinking and feeling society. So I want to be careful to avoid too much gender essentialism, while at the same time recognizing that, yes, certainly these women and their methods made an enormous contribution to how we think and do research now.
Yeah, I'm so glad you brought that up, because it's true. A lot of what we tend to talk about in the West is Western research. Mm-hmm. And a lot of research from Japan, particularly on primates, isn't brought to the forefront unless you're actually looking for it in Western research.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Yeah, that's a really good point. And when you have researched animals, or other animals than humans, what animals have you focused on primarily?
My own research has involved wild baboons in Kenya and captive great apes in various places. But at the time I was doing that research, I was involved much more in studying learning and cognition. So my own research wasn't specifically about emotions. And of course, it's very challenging for field workers to, you know, you don't wait around until someone dies and then look for grief. You know, your research is going on and there may be a death that one can then pay attention to. So I began to become very interested in doing a kind of synthesis research where I would talk to people who worked in animal sanctuaries, in some cases zoos, read a lot of the literature. And in the beginning, I was finding evidence for big-brained mammals such as chimpanzees and orcas and elephants and so on for the expression of grief at the time of the death of a companion. But I felt that there had to be more than this. And there was more than this. I just had to look harder. And I ended up being very interested in documenting grief, which I have done in farmed animals, companion animals, including dogs and cats, certain birds. So again, this is an approach that kind of tried to bring together in a somewhat new way at the time, a number of accounts and put them into a logical framework and talk about them. It's a very wide variety of animals we now know to express grief. It's been almost a decade since I wrote that book, How Animals Grieve. And we know that there are ferrets and giraffes and different types of birds and bison. You know, I could go on. So the number of species seems to increase the more we look. And that is a testament to the fact that one has to ask the question before you can find the answer.
And how do you look for grief, or how do you observe it and write it down? What do you actually do?
Yeah. When I look for grief, I'm looking for a response on the part of a survivor of some death that is more than just fleeting or momentary, that is a real significant departure from the normal behavior. And this then clearly implies that we have to know something about the lives of these animals before we make a determination about grief. So, you know, a 5-minute video or a still photo that's shared in the media can't do it. You have to know a little bit about before and after. So this may be a social withdrawal in grief. It may be a failure to eat or sleep or travel in the normal ways, coupled with a change in posture, vocalization, facial expression, any number of these things. And sometimes there are things that happen that, you know, don't mirror our own grief. With primates, often there's a kind of acting out at the body, a display, even dragging the body. That doesn't necessarily mean that it isn't grief. It doesn't look like what human grief looks like. And that's really the challenge, is that so much of what we tend to look for is reflective of how we behave. And what I'm trying to do is really open up my mind and see what is a visible expression of grief for other animals. What might I not be expecting to see? So it really depends highly on both the species, the individual, and the context. But I will say that in all of the cases I'm describing, there's something that is striking, that's really profound, that is, of course, visible to us looking on, that suggests profound emotion beyond something very temporary, beyond just stress.
And what are you seeing any similarities across species for those behaviors?
I would say that time spent at the body in what I would describe as a thoughtful, emotional way, to the best that I can decode that in other animals, is a kind of pattern. So that there's an attraction to the body, perhaps a vigil at the body. With elephants, it may be rocking over the body. With chimpanzees, it may be tending to the body. There's a couple of examples with chimpanzees I could give you. One in which the dominant male of the wild community actually did gatekeeping, keeping other juveniles, except the dead chimpanzee's brother, away from the body, being very clearly observant of who should come forward and who should not. A separate case in which a very close friend, if you will, of the dead chimpanzee cleaned his teeth in death. There's a lot of care, and this is perhaps not what we might feel totally comfortable calling mortuary rituals, but yet it's something in that ballpark. And you see, for example, with bison, a grouping of animals around the body, certainly with cows that may happen. And so I'm interested in those moments and days after the death of really the site of attraction around the body. And then once that's over, some survivors may really be quite withdrawn. And if we're talking about companion animals in a home, they may search the home and not eat, that kind of thing. People will ask me, well, if they're searching, do they understand that the other one is gone? And my definition of grief doesn't require a cognitive processing of the concept of death. It's more that I'm suggesting that there's a profound emotional reaction to separation from the loved one.
Okay. So they don't necessarily understand that their companion has died. They just...
Well, some may. Very much don't want to rule out the possibility of a cognitive grasp of death. There's some very good writing about this that's coming out now, suggesting that a large number of animals do understand that there's been a permanent change in some way in their companion. In other words, they are no longer moving. They are no longer participating in life, and that there's a clear framework for knowing that. I mean, we could expect that many animals are highly aware of who's breathing, moving, participating. And I don't want to deny that to other animals. But what I don't want to insist upon is some cognitive processing in a really conceptual way that's, you know, that is like our understanding of death. We just don't know. But I don't think that's necessary for a definition of the expression of grief.
Right. And you're not saying necessarily either that every animal in a species grieves, but that it's seen in many species.
Yeah, there are many species in which, as far as we are aware, no animals grieve. I wouldn't necessarily expect to take one of my favorite animals, spiders, to grieve. I mean, I would want to ask the question always, but would I expect that? Not necessarily. Trout, beetles, frogs, you know, I don't know. But even in the animals who routinely express grief, there will be tremendous difference in individuals, just as there are such differences in humans. Some may, for all we know, be grieving in totally invisible ways to us. You know, this is not about trying to enter an animal's mind and know what they're thinking. We have to work with visible signs. And if you think about in the wild, selection pressures in evolution have really pushed animals in many cases to hide any kind of vulnerability. And just as they might hide a physical limp from a predator, they may hide an emotional vulnerability, a sadness, a depression. So we may be vastly underestimating the expression of grief in wild animals. But there's also just personality differences. You know, among the cats with whom I live, some are very attuned to others and really seem to care what's happening in our little family, and others are more just to themselves. So we would want to take into account all kinds of variables in both wild and domestically.
Right. Yeah. It reminds me of a story at the end of Suzanne Clothier's book, Bones Would Rain from the Sky. If dogs' prayers were answered, bones would rain from the sky. And she was talking about her German shepherds and how her German shepherds, you know, she always, if one of her dogs dies, she brings in the other shepherds to see the body and to so that they can understand. And she has found it always to be a situation where they are very calm and they sniff the body and they seem to understand that this companion is no longer there. And when a friend of hers needed help with a golden retriever who had passed away and what she should do with her other golden retriever to help him sort of get through it, she said, well, you know, maybe help him, you know, let him see the body and see it. And she did this, and the golden retriever dropped his ball on the body and then jumped around and then hopped out of the grave.
Yeah, beautiful example of variability.
He did not seem to notice.
Yeah, I did a TED talk some years ago on how animals grieve. And I mentioned in there that on a talk show one time, a woman called in and said, one of my dogs died and the other isn't grieving. What's wrong with this dog? Mm-hmm. And we talked about the household composition, and this dog was now the alpha and the only dog in the house, and he was joyous. So, you know, we just can't make assumptions across the board.
And I would like to apologize to Barbara for not bringing this up during the conversation, because while we were chatting, I understood the context in which she was using the term alpha, and I think you probably did as well. However, just for the sake of accuracy, the term alpha arose from the book, The Wolf Ecology and Behavior of Endangered Species by David Meach. However, as you can read on his website, which of course I will link in the show notes, quote, one of the outdated pieces of information is the concept of the alpha wolf, which implies competing with others and becoming top dog by winning a contest or battle. However, most wolves who lead packs achieve their position simply by mating and producing pups, which then become their pack. In other words, they are merely breeders or parents, end quote. This concept of alpha has been used to describe dogs within human families as well. And while there is no doubt that dominance hierarchies can and do exist among many social animals, in the case of dogs in a household, it is much more appropriate to describe the relationship between the dogs as just that, a relationship. If one dog happens to be dominant during certain activities, like eating, that does not imply that they are also dominant during other activities, i.e. playing. And they certainly are not the leaders or breeders of the family group, which is typically the humans. So while one dog may be grieving or not another dog's passing, it is more appropriate to consider this a relationship issue rather than a dominance issue. The other dog may in fact be happy to be the only dog in the house, so he does not have to share his resources, but that doesn't make him the alpha. The reason I felt this was important to interject is because the concept of alpha has been misused and misunderstood for a very long time within the lay community of dog enthusiasts. And this misunderstanding has caused many a dog to be physically subordinated, unintentionally abused, and even euthanized for being too dominant by their human companion. I would love for the term alpha to go the way of the dodo, so we can get on to building better relationships with our dogs. Okay, now that that's been said, let's go back to talking with Barbara King about the world of grief. You know, what do you see the value of studying grief is?
I would give several answers. And first, and probably most obviously, is we need every window that we can find into the interior lives of animals. We need to know who we're sharing the earth with. And I think that the expression of grief is a really good one because there are such visible signs and we are constrained to only being able to work with visible expressions of interior lives. So the idea that animals, you know, posturally, vocally, behaviorally are showing us this, are telling us this, it's a great window into understanding something about their lives. But I also think it can be a great comfort to us. I mean, we grieve, humans. I don't know of any human being really who is likely to go through a life without grief. And I think it would be a sad life because I think there'd be less love in that life. And to know that we're not alone and that we feel other beings around us who also have these deep emotional states, at least to me, is a real solace. Probably most importantly, I think it's a motivator for me to try to help animals to realize that not only do individuals, you know, die and their survivors may be feeling this depending on the species, depending on the individual, but that when we put animals in harmful situations, we may be causing a ripple effect through whole families and networks. You know, if you take an animal from the wild, like an Indonesian macaque, and put that animal in a laboratory, that's disruptive. That animal is gone and as good as dead to the whole network behind. If you put an orca in a theme park, you know, same thing. If you're not fighting hard enough for habitat restoration for elephants, you're causing whole family disruption and extra death. So I really see this as a way to understand that these animals have whole lives. They matter and their families' lives are disrupted when their lives are disrupted. And the last point I would make is that I think many of us are coping with a different kind of grief now, a kind of ecological grief for the earth. I think grief is on so many people's minds due to urgent climate change, species extinction, all the things that we're facing, as well as humanitarian crises. So coming up more and more and more in my conversations are dialogues between artists and scientists of how do we manage this grief and how do we understand that we have to adapt to a changing world, even as we're fighting for good things, to really try to think about grief in a framework of resilience in some way. So all those reasons together.
Yeah. You know, it really struck me what you said about the orcas as well, because here in the Pacific Northwest, orcas were removed from the wild in many great numbers over the years. And the number of families that must have devastated and has continued to, you know, have a ripple reaction, not just through the families themselves when it happened, but even through the generations, as we are lacking in our resident orcas now because they were so easy to capture because they hung out in one area. And now our orca pods and families are just diminishing. And a lot of that is because, they were taken away from their families and put into places like SeaWorld and other organizations.
Oh, it's so devastating. And you're so right. When it was now, what, 4 summers ago when Tahlequah Orca carried out her grief swim. This, of course, was in the Salish Sea in July of 2018 when she gave birth to a daughter who died. And she kept the daughter on her body, refusing to give it up for 17 days, 1,000 miles. And I think that really is an example of how the public, as well as scientists, can be galvanized by watching an animal exhibiting profound emotion, profound connection to her daughter. And we began, those of us who didn't know already, to learn more about the orcas and just the types of things you're describing, and the extent that the pollution and the salmon reductions are all affecting them, all of these anthropogenic harms. I think it's incredibly important.
Do you think it's going to make a difference to people who farm animals as well, sheep and cows and that sort of thing, to understand that these animals can experience grief?
I think it depends so much on the farm. I doubt that factory farmers are going to care, unfortunately. I do think there's all different kinds of farms, moderate-sized family farms. I think that farmers probably know a whole lot of what scientists go on later to discover. The farmers have been around these animals, pay attention to these animals. It's a very fraught topic for me because I'm not really a believer in a concept of humane slaughter. So while factory farms are the worst farms among us, I also know that animals die way, way early on farms. And that is a great concern that embraces both animal welfare and animal rights. And we know that dairy cows are one of the best examples of grieving animals because on dairy farms of any size, very, very typically, the newborns are taken from the moms within 24 to 48 hours because, of course, they don't get mom's milk. The mom's milk is kept for humans. So we have farmers who are attuned to other animals, but yet continue this practice of causing dairy moms to grieve very, very visibly. They bellow, they pace, they're agitated. So it's hard for me to be completely hopeful about that when this is a business and when money is the bottom line.
Yeah. People have it's very easy for people to set aside their emotional discomfort if it comes down to their economics.
Yeah, that is very true in farming. It's true in the biomedical research community. It's true in the entertainment community. You know, one could go on, but I think that is a fair statement.
So if it isn't going to help those sorts of situations, you think, you don't have a lot of confidence that it will, it sounds like. Do you think that it's still, or you say, in terms of the value of it, is it still worth doing? Is it still worth knowing?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's up to us. We are the consumers, right? The farmers are producing whether it is beef or dairy milk or pork and bacon for us. If we don't eat it, then we're making a statement that, dear farmers, you may not be attuned to these animals, but we are. So I think that it is very much not only up to us, because we need legislation and we need all kinds of governmental involvement, but it's we have a role to play. So the last book I wrote is called Animals' Best Friends, Putting Compassion to Work for Animals in the Wild and in Captivity. This just came out last year. And the whole reason I wrote that book was to compel people to think about how on an individual level, we can make a difference for animals. And what we can do for animals in farms is not to eat them. What we can do for animals in zoos is to stay away from roadside zoos, perhaps keep our eyes open in other zoos and speak up about bad conditions for animals in biomedical laboratories. I'm working on this every day to really know what happens to these animals. Fight hard for animal-free research. Invest in that kind of technology, those kinds of products. So in other words, I want to emphasize that I don't think individual action is sufficient, but it's absolutely necessary. And I know for a fact that people who just read the work of animal scientists, watch documentaries about animal emotion, do get fired up, do get motivated, do change their behavior. I have no doubt that it makes a difference.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like that for animals at you know, orcas at SeaWorld and things like that too. Yeah, don't go. Mm-hmm. If you don't like what happened a long time ago, it doesn't mean that it's still okay to go.
Absolutely. And I have never been, so I couldn't tell you about SeaWorld as I don't go. But I think that we do have choices every day. It's very typical to hear that we have three meals a day and three choices to help animals. And that's so important. But every time we make a choice about entertainment or, you know, as a patient, as a cancer patient, which I was some years ago, I really didn't have a choice to walk into my doctor and say, oh, no, you know, I can't have surgery, chemotherapy and radiation that was tested on animals. I'm going to die if I do that. But what I can do now that I'm healthy is to work for alternatives and work for restructuring of funding and work for example, with members of Congress, you know, to talking to them about this kind of thing. So whatever one's abilities and access are, I feel it is our responsibility to really, really speak up and to fight hard, and that the study of animal emotion can be one tool to help us feel motivated to do that, to know that we're surrounded by animals who, you know, have good days and bad days, who tell us in so many ways that they want to live and they want to live pain-free. I feel very passionate about that.
Absolutely. Yeah. What other emotions do you think are important for us to be looking at?
Fear, stress, trauma. I mean, to look at the things that happen, again, in harmful contexts. I think that fear has, of course, been accepted as an animal emotion for a very long time, but not so much in the context that I'm talking about. For example, we have good peer-reviewed literature to show that elephants who witness their parents killed in the wild or are somehow caught up in a terrible poaching event, they do have nightmares. They do exhibit PTSD, post-traumatic stress in some way. We know that chimpanzees who are held in zoos may often show mental health issues. I could go on and on. And of course, anyone who has lived with a dog or cat who came from a difficult past experience knows that it's just a myth to say that these animals live only in the present. I mean, it's this romantic notion, right? That dogs will anchor you in the present. They're always going to be ready for a play romp. They can keep you in the moment. And that's true to a certain extent. But a dog who has had any kind of abuse or traumatic experience carries that forward often. And we know they remember. We know they think about these things. And I live with cats and I see that too. So I want people to understand that what happens in the moment to an animal doesn't just stay in the moment in many cases. And that is what might be called a negative look at emotions. But the flip side is, of course, with love, attention, time, and patience, many, many times those things can be greatly overcome to then move and morph into expressions of joy and play and just explosions of joy. It's wonderful. You see cows who were rescued from the slaughterhouse, or chimpanzees who are let out of the biomedical laboratory. And you see that many, not all, but many are open, or at least trying to move past this terrible, vulnerable experience and be open to happier moments.
Yeah. It's so, I think we all feel so much emotion when we see those sorts of things also. It's, you know, that's why those sorts of videos become viral and get shared so much, isn't it? Because we do have that connection to seeing the catharsis of another animal becoming joyful.
It's a very hopeful thing to see and to share and to know that, you know, any of us who have gone through something difficult, again, it's just the same thing with the expression of grief. We see continuity. We see common experiences. We see shared emotions. We see hope. And hope is wonderful. But I also think we can stop putting animals in those situations from which they have to recover.
Well, that would be nice. You know, something you said earlier too about one of the reasons why you do this, in that seeing other animals have emotional experiences and deep emotional experiences is important to you because it makes us feel less alone. It makes us feel that we're connected to animals because we share some aspect of emotions with them. And it got me thinking to a book I read again, ages ago. And again, it was a dog book, of course, mm-hmm. where the author was talking about how dogs are mostly mechanical and they didn't really love you. They just love the fact that you give them food. And so they've learned to act the way that you perceive love because of this, you know, they've learned how to get food from you essentially and how to get attention. And, book was the worst. I was just thinking, no, this is not right. This can't. The fact that somebody even wants to believe this, or could believe this, based on the evidence that's out there, just blew my mind. And I didn't want to share that book with anyone because it was just, just the worst.
Good call. There's a book I reviewed for the TLS in London recently by a zoologist called Jules Howard, and it's called Wonder Dogs. And it has a subtitle that has something to do with the history of dogs in experimental research. Mm-hmm. And at the end, he comes out and says that he actually wants to retract things he's been saying for years about how dogs don't experience and express love. And he says it took him a long time, but he does believe that now. And I was thinking, yes, I mean, why? Because a lot of research, not just dog experience, but research is beginning to really open people's eyes, even zoologists, you know. So especially, my gosh, if you're a cat person, people tell you all the time that you're just falling for it. You know, they're rubbing up against you because they want food and they're just manipulating you. And I can give so many examples, including when I was ill with cancer, with a particular cat who was so attuned to me and came and sat with me on days that were hard, you know, with chemo. And nothing to do with her getting resources from me, but rather a sense of attunement, a sense of understanding, an expression of caring. When I was grieving my own mother's death, which is now 7 years ago, we adopted a 10-year-old cat who had been turned back into a shelter apart from his own mother, who was still living at that time. He was all alone. And we adopted him, and he and I grieved together and came through recovery together. I make no claim that, again, he had the same conceptual sense exactly of life, death, and grief, but he was grieving. There was no question that he was depressed and grieving. And we, I believe, recognized something about each other's states and helped each other recover.
Yeah, absolutely. It's, you know, they talk about disenfranchised grief a lot when it comes to when animals and your companion animals die, and people are often told, oh, well, at least it was just a dog, you know, I lost my parent or something like that. And with children, this is a particularly big issue as well. You know, people don't like seeing other people upset. And when they have control, I think, over a child, they can tell the child, well, it was just a cat or just a dog or just a goldfish, and you don't have to feel that bad about it. And it just tells the kid that what they're feeling isn't important. But there is, I think there must be also something similar in disenfranchised love. If you're told that, you know, the love you're experiencing with your cat or your dog isn't true. It isn't real. Mm-hmm. That is extremely painful to hear.
It's painful. It's wrong. It's a type of denial and dismissal of what people know in their hearts, as well as being a denial and dismissal of what the animals are actually capable of expressing. It's very harmful. I don't like it. And I do speak up and speak back when people talk about that kind of thing. I mean, this isn't to say that there might not be indifferent cats. Of course there could be. There are all kinds of personalities, as there are with people. So my claims are not universal, but, you know, don't come to me and deny my experience living 7, 8, 10 years with a cat and tell me that, you know better. No, not going to work.
Yeah, I like that you say that it's wrong too, because, you know, what we feel doesn't make something right, but evidence does. Evidence can show us the right way to look and the wrong way.
Yes. And at the same time, I do fully believe that many people's evidence does come from lived experience. You know, as an anthropologist, I know that lived experience itself should be considered evidence. And I don't mean to say that whatever anyone says on any topic automatically should be anointed as truth. Obviously not. Living in the United States in 2022, we don't want to say that. But I will say that people who are careful observers, who are attuned to animals, who care for animals, they learn things through that interaction that may then years later be sort of cemented by evidence. So it goes both ways.
Yeah, 100%. Well, if there was a book that you could gift to all the listeners besides your books, because of course they should have those, but if there was a book besides yours, what book would you gift to the listeners?
I think my first impulse would be to recommend or give some kind of hard-hitting expose of the agricultural industry. And then I would think about it and think, no, my second impulse is probably better. I would pick a book that is called The Good, Good Pig. It has a subtitle, The Extraordinary Life of Christopher Hogwood. This is written by Cy Montgomery, who is a friend of mine, but is also an internationally known author about animals. If you know Cy Montgomery, you might think first and foremost of The Soul of an Octopus. She's very, very well known for that book. But the book that I'm talking about, The Good, Good Pig, tells the story of her adoption of a pig at 6 months, who then goes on to live for 14 years. And he has wonderful adventures, experiences, takes in and expresses emotion. And I think what it does through, you know, joy on the page and laughter and humor and a few tears here and there tells you exactly what I want people to know, that this pig would have been killed at 6 months in the agricultural industry, and that he lived a life that was wonderful, that left an imprint on many, many people and has this amazing legacy. I mean, it's a fun, fun book, but it has a strong message. And I would give that to anyone who would take it from me.
Lovely. Would you share a formative childhood memory that was sort of demonstrates your connection between you and animals, other animals?
I remember always having cats in my life, and clearly, those experiences when I was growing up in suburban New Jersey in the 1960s made a big impression, because I've always lived with cats. My husband and I have rescued homeless cats. And I can remember very clearly the first time my mother explained to me that this cat was about to have kittens. Back then, we didn't spay neuter very much. We kept our cats, you know, safe, and we were very, very careful to adopt out the kittens to good families, but we didn't spay neuter. So we had a lot of cats and there were kittens. One cat went into my room, into a drawer in my cabinet where I kept my clothes, and chose that place to have her kittens. And I just felt, even at a very young age, wow, you know, there's this whole house and she chose this. She's expressing something to me. That's the coolest thing ever. And I remember that, you know, decades later.
That is the coolest thing ever. I also remember when my cats had kittens, because yes, we didn't spay neuter very much back then. And where they were going to have their kittens was always such a big question. Like, whose room are they going to choose? You know, what spots? We'd make lots of little spots in the house to, you know, hopefully get them comfortable. And yeah.
Yeah, there's so many lessons there. I mean, there's choice, you know, there's individual autonomy on the part of the cat. There's, you know, a sense of warmth if you get to be chosen. And then, of course, watching the mom taking care of the kittens throughout that whole developmental period. That's a lot to learn for a kid, for a little kid that I was. Yeah. And it really just made a huge impression on me.
Yeah, it's amazing. I'm not going to go around having cats and letting them breed uncontrollably, but I found a way to help my kids have that experience is by fostering mama cats with their kittens, because that is so necessary. And I really can't do the bottle feeding at the moment, just too much, too much for me. But I'm amazed at people who can do that. It's fantastic. But bringing the mom in with her kittens, just letting her have that space to raise her kittens so that they can all find homes. And it's just such a nice thing to share with your kids. And I think fostering is an excellent way of doing that for people.
It's a wonderful thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So what do you think is the deal with animals?
Oh, I have need an hour for that. But I think one big deal with animals is that they're not voiceless. I hear so often animal advocates who are wonderful, doing wonderful work, saying we need to stand up for animals because they don't have a voice and we do. And I think everything that I've been talking about here in this interview and really my whole body of work is trying to say they do have a voice. I mean, they express themselves, they express their emotions through visible behaviors, visible postures, visible expressions on their faces, and also vocalizations. So whether it is something like joy, love, fear, or grief, that whole suite of emotions, if we're looking, we can see it. At a more fundamental level, I think what animals voice in any number of these varied ways is, again, that they want to live. They want to live without pain. They want to live without fear. I mean, I see this so clearly in any number of animals. And once you see it, you can't unsee it. So I just want us to know, yes, of course, it's our responsibility. We must do better for animals, but we don't want to deny to them their ability to enlist us in this work. I do believe that's what's happening.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for coming on the show today. I really appreciate it.
I enjoyed talking with you. Thank you.
That was professor and author Barbara King. Her works include Animals' Best Friends, Putting Compassion to Work for Animals in Captivity and the Wild, Personalities on the Plate, and of course, How Animals Grieve. She's a freelance writer and public speaker, and you can find out more about her work at barbarajking.com. If you enjoyed this show and have any questions or comments about this episode or about the podcast in general, go to thedealwithanimals.com and leave me a message. This is also a great place to go if you're interested in being a guest or have an idea for a series or episode. And don't forget to follow and review wherever you listen to your podcast, as it helps us become more visible to other listeners. I'm your host, Marika Bell. I'd like to thank Kai Stranskoff for the theme music and Natasha Matsark for help with editing. You can see links to guest book recommendations, as well as their websites and affiliated organizations, in the show notes and at thedealwithanimals.com. Thank you for joining me as we try to answer the question, what's the deal with animals? So, what do you think is the deal with animals? The Deal with Animals is part of the iROAR Animal Podcast Network.